You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. As part of the Treaty of Paris, in which Great Britain recognized the new United States of America, Britain ceded the land that comprised the immense Northwest Territory, a wilderness empire northwest of the Ohio River containing the future states of Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin. A Massachusetts minister named Manessa Cutler was instrumental in opening this vast territory to veterans of the Revolutionary War and their families for settlement. Those settlers created a town in a primeval wilderness, and they let no obstacle deter or defeat them. Now, in a brand new book titled The Pioneers, The Heroic Story of the Settlers Who Brought the American Ideal West, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David McCullough rediscovers this important and dramatic chapter in the American story, the settling of the Northwest Territory by dauntless pioneers who overcame incredible hardships to build a community based on ideals that would come to define our country. And today, I'm delighted to finally have David McCullough on the show to talk about the book, how it fulfilled a lifelong dream of his to write a nonfiction version of Thornton Wilder's Our Town, and why it should serve as a reminder of fundamental American values at a time when many of those values seem to be under attack. We discuss the New England parson who played an instrumental role in the creation of the Ohio settlement, how he fought to make Ohio a free territory at a time when not even the original 13 states had fully outlawed slavery, and how just a few years later, that parson's son stopped slavery again in a dramatic showdown with Ohio's Jeffersonians. He talks about the wealthy Irish couple who built a paradise on an island in the middle of the Ohio River and how they lost everything when they became embroiled in a treasonous plot with the notorious Aaron Burr. Then McCullough shares what he's learned in his 50-plus years of studying history. He reveals how history comes alive every time he dives into a new project and how often his subjects begin to feel like old friends, and he talks about the importance of hindsight and reevaluation. Coming up with David McCullough in just a moment. David McCullough is America's greatest living historian, the author of 12 books, and the recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He has twice received the Pulitzer Prize for his books Truman and John Adams, and twice received the National Book Award for The Path Between the Seas and Mornings on Horseback. His other acclaimed books include The Johnstown Flood, The Great Bridge, Brave Companions, 1776, The Great Journey, and The Wright Brothers. Now he's written about a lesser-known but no less engaging chapter in American history in his latest book, The Pioneers, The Heroic Story of the Settlers Who Brought the American Ideal West. Mr. David McCullough, thanks for joining me.
My pleasure, and I'm delighted to be included. And you don't specialize in trick questions, is that right?
No, I don't think so. I can't imagine okay. What would trick you at this point in your career.
Yeah.
Well, I have to tell you, it is such an honor to finally have you on the show. I've been a big fan of yours ever since I first read Mornings on Horseback, gosh, so many years ago, I guess. And I thoroughly enjoyed the new book, The Pioneers.
Thank you.
You say that this book was the culmination of a long-desired plan to write a nonfiction equivalent of Thornton Wilder's Our Town. And I believe that you knew him personally.
I did know Mr. Wilder. He was a fellow, as they called him, at Yale University when I was an undergraduate there. Talk about the privileges of an education of that kind.
Yeah.
He was often in the dining hall at lunch or at dinner even, and you could go over and sit down and chat with him, talk with him. And he was a very warm-spirited and obviously stimulating man and interested in us and interested in having debates or conversations about this or that. And then I saw Our Town and was just swept away with it. But ever since then, I've had this dream that maybe someday I would write a nonfiction book, a history book, about a town and about people you've never heard of and make them come to life. I always felt that we have in our story as a nation hundreds, if not thousands, of people who have led interesting and or admirable and or adventurous lives about whom we know nothing. I've always felt, too, that the community in which we grow up, in which we have our outlook on life formed, and the people who make a community and who live their lives out in the community are just as interesting and as compelling as human beings as the main characters of a play like Thornton Wilder's Our Town. But the chances of ever finding a collection of material from which that book could be drawn were so remote that I imagined I probably would never be able to do it.
Happily for you, you did eventually find that story. How did you stumble onto your own real-life Our Town?
In a combination of immense good luck and accelerating curiosity, I found material in the small town in Ohio called Marietta. Not only was this all in one library, but a beautiful library on a beautiful college campus, Marietta College, and furthermore, in the town where most of the story takes place.
Yeah.
So when I was working there, I was not just working with the voices, if you will, of all these people, but I was there where they were. And so that injected me with a feeling of being part of them.
You've been writing about American history for 50 years and probably thought you knew every story there is. Did you feel a particular joy of discovery when you came across this largely forgotten chapter in history?
It was beyond anything I could have ever imagined. Now, I've done an immense amount of work and spent many years working in some of the greatest libraries and archival collections in the world. But never have I had the thrill, the excitement of coming upon material such as was in that library in Marietta, Ohio, on the Marietta College campus. The material numbers in the thousands, letters, diaries, wow, unpublished memoirs. But it's not just the quantity of the material. It's the quality of the writing, the quality of the thinking, the quality of the values that these people held to in their very brave and difficult expedition west.
Usually when I think of America's westward expansion later on, I often think of very rough-hewn sorts, gold prospectors, land speculators, and other kind of ne'er-do-wells who may or may not have been fleeing warrants and all manner of trouble back in the States.
Right.
In contrast to that, the Ohio settlement was led by men of truly exceptional character. What attracted such gentlemen to the wilderness?
There was this need by the people who organized this particular project, the Ohio Company, as it was called, to carry forth what they considered to be the ideals of a good society, the ideals of a good civilization. For example, public education, education for everybody, from grade school through college. Nothing like that existed anywhere in the United States at the time. And of course, it gave birth to the whole state university system as we know it and take for granted today. Also, it included freedom of religion, complete freedom of religion, an aspiration, though that was not always lived up to treat the natives with respect and not to in any way violate the decency of what they considered the good community. Most important of all, there would be no slavery.
Right, and at that time, those rights, and especially freedom from slavery, weren't even guaranteed to that extent in the original 13 states.
These people felt that just putting all men are created equal into words wasn't sufficient. All men were created equal, it said our Declaration of Independence, but in fact, in all of the 13 colonies, now 13 states, there were slaves. They were saying, when you cross the line into this, our new realm, Ohio, you will be crossing into a place in our country where there will be indeed no slaves.
And perhaps the man most responsible for that, and also the man without whom there might not have been an Ohio settlement, was this fascinating and brilliant polymath, Manessa Cutler. He's something of a forgotten figure in American history, but over and over, he just seems to pop up on the periphery of seminal moments in the nation's founding, and he's interacting with founding fathers like Adams, Jefferson, Franklin, and others, kind of like an early American Forrest Gump. Tell us a little about him.
Manessa Cutler was, like Benjamin Franklin, a classic 18th century polymath. In other words, somebody who's interested in and knows a great deal about almost everything. He was three doctors in one. He was a doctor of law, a doctor of medicine, and a doctor of divinity. He spent his life primarily as a parson, a minister at the church in what is now Hamilton, Massachusetts. But he was also, if not the leading botanist anywhere, a leading botanist in our country. And he was interested in new languages, interested in everything. And he set out in the summer of 1787 to the Capitol, then in New York. He'd never been out of New England, to lobby, as we now would say, the word expression hadn't been developed yet, but to lobby for this idea of a new part of our country where there would be no slavery and there'd be public education and the rest. And the miracle of it is he did it.
Let me ask you this, David. What drove the first pioneers to settle the Ohio Territory? What were they coming there for?
Well, several things. First of all, as few people know, and I must admit I didn't know until recently, there was a depression that followed the Revolutionary War that lasted almost as long as the war itself, which had lasted 8.5 years. And it was a worse depression even in many ways, than was the famous depression of the 1930s.
Really?
It was terrible, and particularly in New England. And, of course, New England farming was always a struggle with all the rock and this really shallow topsoil. And here was land where the topsoil was maybe 4 or 5 feet deep and magnificent trees from which could be made all kinds of products, including boats that could go to sea by going further on down the Ohio to the Mississippi, then on down to New Orleans and out to sea, which, in fact, would happen.
What kind of adversities were those early settlers up against when they came to Ohio?
You'd make a long list. They had the adversity of just clearing the trees. The trees were gigantic. There was one stump of a tree which had hollowed out, and the stump raised up above the ground maybe 12 feet or so, and six men on horses could get inside that stump to give you some idea of how big these trees
wow,
were.
That's huge.
Yes, they were primeval. They'd never been cut down, ever. And then there was a question of what were you going to eat? You had to grow corn, you had to live on deer and turkeys, and in the meantime, you also had forest all around you, the howling wilderness, they said, which was full of wolves and bears and wildcats and rattlesnakes. And, of course, there was always the possible threat of the natives. In addition to that, they had violent storms, blizzards. They had floods, the likes of which they never anticipated. They even had an earthquake. And then they had epidemic disease, smallpox, influenza. No hospitals. There were a few doctors, but very few. And no drug stores, and no Band-Aids, and no Kleenex, and no anesthetics.
Yeah.
If you were going to have a tooth pulled, or you were giving birth to a child. So what they used for anesthetic was whiskey.
And it's hard to imagine my generation muddling through and surviving against those kind of odds. They certainly had grit, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. I've been reading David Brooks' new book, The Second Mountain, and he has some wonderful material about the benefits, if you will, of suffering. And oh, did these people suffer. And oh, did they work. And oh, did they endure hardship. I feel now, after spending these years with them, that we're all a bunch of softies compared to those people. No, truly, we are.
Sure.
Spoiled. Spoiled beyond imagining.
Yeah, and what's interesting about this is that despite all of these adversities, The Pioneers is a book that's full of stories of generosity and neighbors helping neighbors and just doing the right thing. Many of the things that we come to identify as American values today.
Well, thank you. And one of my favorite parts of the whole story is about generosity. And I want to read you just a little bit of it. They established themselves in 1788 at Marietta on the Ohio River at the junction of the Muskingum River. End of the second summer, in early October, there was a very early frost which killed the corn. And so what followed was a winter of near starvation. But what saved the settlement was generosity. Joe Barker, who was one of the five main characters in my book, said it was a powerful lesson in life. Quote, where poverty, improvidence, and scarcity meet, he wrote, charity and benevolence only could give relief. Later, Marietta's earliest historian, another one of my characters, Samuel Hildreth, was to write, in this great scarcity, it was wonderful how little there was of selfishness, how generally kindness and good feeling abounded. Those who had more resources lent or gave to those who had less, unquote. One family in particular came to the rescue in a way never to be forgotten, Isaac and Rebecca Williams, immigrant farmers from Pennsylvania, who were known and admired for their consistently abundant harvests. To those now starving, Mr. Williams sold his corn at the usual price of 50 cents a bushel, instead of the then-going price of $2.50 a bushel. To the desperately poor, he let them have it without payment. To speculators who offered to buy all he had, he refused to sell even a bushel. Joseph Barker, in his later reminiscences, would recount how two heads of families told Williams they had no bread and had come for what corn they could get with as little money as they had. How many is there of you? Said Mr. Williams. Rising of 20 was the reply. Wow. Dang it, says the old man. There's a heap of you, but you must have a bushel apiece. And they had. In other words, he gave it to them. It's a lesson we can never forget.
What was the relationship like between the settlers and the Indians?
Well, in this case, it was very healthy. When they first arrived, Captain Pipe, as he was called, who was the chief of the Delawares, greeted them warmly where they landed. It was only after natives began to realize that these weren't the only people coming. In other words, they kept coming year after year in greater and greater numbers. Also, some of the tribes were not very friendly, and some of the things that the other white people, other than those that came out to Marietta, did some atrocious things themselves. Dreadful killings on both sides. But Rufus Putnam, the general, had been Washington's civil engineer, if you will, and he built what he called a stockade, not a fort, but it was a place where settlers could retreat to in the case of attack. But as it turned out, because of the attitude that Putnam himself fostered and made the rule of the community of treating the Indians with respect, the Indians, even when there was full-scale warfare, never attacked the settlement at Marietta.
Well, it wasn't all struggle and misery. There are also some humorous and uplifting moments in the book. And thanks to all of these great diaries and letters that you discovered, we really get a full picture of who the pioneers were. Do you have any favorite stories that highlight the essential humanity of these early pioneers?
I mean, you have to remember about the people who lived earlier. They were human beings. History is about people. It's about the human story, the human side. And part of that was they were humorous. One of my favorite stories is about the time that people came in a hurry to the stockade because they were having an attack, or they thought they were going to have an attack. And Joe Barker, who was in his way a wonderful writer, described what happened. And if I may, I'd like to read you just a bit of this.
Please.
"All was consternation," wrote Joseph Barker, who with his family was still quartered in the garrison stockade, and who went on to describe the scene in his own distinctive way. "Everyone made immediately for his alarm post. The first person for admittance at the central blockhouse was Colonel E. Sprout, with a box of papers. Then came some young men with their arms. Then a woman with her bed and children. Then came old Mr. William Moulton from Newburyport, age 70, with his leather apron full of old goldsmith's tools and tobacco. His daughter Anna brought the china teapot, cups and saucers. Lydia brought the great Bible. But when all were in, Mother was missing. Where was Mother? She must be killed. No, says Lydia, the daughter. Mother said she would not leave a house looking so. She would put things a little to rights, and then she would come. Directly Mother came, bringing the looking-glass, knives, forks, and spoons, etc. But I just love that scene, that she's not going to leave that house in a mess, even if the attack was coming.
Yeah.
Another my favorite scene is the old fellow named Jediah Bagley, who was an itinerant violinist, or fiddler, as they call him. He'd play at weddings and dances and so forth. He roamed from settlement to settlement, and he was outside Marietta, not far from Marietta, one night, and he got chased by wolves. It was in the snow, and he managed to pull himself up a willow tree by the riverbank, and somehow or other he got his fiddle out of its pack on his back. Wrapping his legs around the tree, he began to play his fiddle for the wolf pack down below. And he played all night long, and eventually they went away. And then he came down, when morning came, he came down out of the tree, and just to be sure he made it back to the town, he played his fiddle all the way through the forest in the snow until he was within safe reach of the village.
He must not be a very good fiddler if he could scare away wolves.
Well, no, I think he charmed them. I think they calmed down and began to appreciate the magic of music.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with David McCullough when we come back in just a minute. On today's episode, I've been talking with Pulitzer Prize winner David McCullough about a dramatic story in American history. But what about your own history? Ancestry DNA gives you so much more than just the places you're from. They've combined DNA results with over 100 million family trees and billions of records to give you more insight into your genealogy and origins. Ancestry connects you to the places in the world where your story started, using precise geographic details and clear-cut historical insights. You can even trace your ancestors' journey over time, following how and why your family moved from place to place. And to amplify your results, you can start a free trial on Ancestry and build a tree so your ancestors become more than just a name. Only Ancestry can tell such a rich story with unique features that give a more complete picture about a person. My wife recently took an Ancestry DNA test to learn more about her Scottish heritage, only to learn that she wasn't Scottish at all. She's Irish. You just never know what kind of surprises might be in store for you when you start exploring your family tree. I just sent in my own Ancestry DNA kit, and being the history buff that I am, I can't wait to find out more about my own family history, see if some of the old family legends are really true, and learn more about where I came from. Talk about the thrill of discovery. So go to Ancestry.com today to purchase your Ancestry DNA kit. That's Ancestry.com to purchase your Ancestry DNA kit. Ancestry.com. And now, back to the show. Now, not all of the early settlers were particularly well-suited to pioneer life. There's one amusing story about some early French settlers who sort of got sold a bill of goods and duped into going to the Ohio Territory. How did they fare?
Oh, not well at all, but their attitude was very charming and winsome. Yeah. And they hardly knew how to do anything other than what they knew how to do as they were making their livings in Paris or other places. Mm-hmm. And their attempt at a community came apart fairly quickly down the river from Marietta.
Two more examples of people who didn't quite fit the mold of the typical rugged pioneer are Harmon and Margaret Blennerhassett, I believe. Now, they created their own little luxury island with a whole mansion in the middle of the wilderness. And Harmon Yes. was later disgraced for supposedly plotting treason with Aaron Burr. There are several interesting theories about what their scheme really entailed. What do we actually know?
Well, we do know that the Blennerhassetts, husband and wife, were very wealthy. They were Irish, and they had inherited a lot of money. And they had come west really to get away from the scorn that had followed them because she was his niece. And so they felt that they went out to the wilderness and found themselves a place where they were in sufficient isolation, nobody would bother them, which turned out to be true. And they built what was the most beautiful mansion on all of the Ohio River at that time. And they led a very plush life on that place, and they furnished it with all the finest furniture available from Europe and New York and so forth. And Burr came along. This was after the duel in which he killed Hamilton, and he was reputedly out to create a new country out of territory controlled by Mexico or wherever. But no one really ever knew exactly what he was up to because he told different people different things depending on his purpose with them. And he saw right away how much money these two people had. And so he moved in on them with all of his charm and got Blennerhassett, the husband, to put up a great deal of money to help him with his cause, promising him a role in the administration of the new country he was going to establish. He was eventually, Ed Burr, was captured and tried for treason, but not convicted because they had no solid evidence. The Blennerhassetts escaped down the rivers too, following after Burr, because they were in big trouble. And the mansion eventually was destroyed by an accidental fire. And it's a great shame, but it's been rebuilt. A recreation of it is there on the island. It's called Blennerhassett Island still today, and is one of the major attractions of people who come to that part of the country because of their interest in history.
With the settling of the Ohio Territory, the Ohio River quickly became one of the essential arteries for trade in early America, first through keelboats and then Robert Fulton invents the steamboat. How much did the steamboat kick commerce along the river into high gear?
Yes, everything changed because the traffic on the river could now be two ways. You could come back upstream too, not just float down the river, and of course at much faster speed than ever before. Rivers are great sources of story. River towns. I grew up in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh is a great story city. Mark Twain discovered this early on, and the story of what went on up and down the Ohio River for so long is really, in many ways, one of the great segments of our whole American story. And it is beautiful. It is still beautiful. During the years I've been doing research out at Marietta, I've stayed at the old Lafayette Hotel, which is right on the river, right on the Ohio, at the point where the pioneers first landed. And to get up in the morning and go out and look at the haze on the water and see the birds of morning and the sun coming up, it evokes a sense of unity with the past that is in harmony with that sense that comes out of the letters and the diaries and the memoirs and the paintings. Incredibly, the collection at Marietta College in the library there includes marvelous oil paintings of how the landscape all looked then, but also of each of the major characters. And of course, I'm trying to get to know them in a time where there was as yet no photography. So to have an oil portrait of each of these five principal characters is in itself a gift beyond the usual.
Earlier, we were talking about Manessa Cutler's fight to establish Ohio as a free territory, but that didn't necessarily settle the issue of slavery once and for all in Ohio. Later on, it comes up again, and interestingly, Manessa's son, Ephraim, plays a pivotal role in keeping slavery out of Ohio. I think it's one of the most dramatic moments in the whole book. Can you tell that story?
10 or 15 years later, when the settlement was underway and Jefferson became president and the Jeffersonian Party was gaining strength everywhere, there was a movement in Ohio to rescind that no slavery rule and to admit slaves to Ohio and thus to the whole Northwest Territory. The battle in the legislature was to keep the rule of no slavery. It was primarily fought and led by Manessa Cutler's son, Ephraim, another one of the main characters in my book. And the day of the vote, he was deathly ill in bed and unable to get out of bed. And his co-sponsor or defender of the no slavery rule, Rufus Putnam, the famous General Rufus Putnam from the Revolution, came to his room and said, "You've got to get up out of bed. They're going to vote today, and you have to be there." Well, there's a story that he was carried into the legislature on a stretcher by Putnam and two or three others, but I found no actual evidence of that. Somehow or other, however, he got there. He got into the legislature. He gave a speech defending the no slavery rule as it stood, and he cast his vote. And the no slavery cause won by one vote. Honestly, if this was all written as a novel, I have a feeling most editors would say, "Well, that's a nice scene, but that wouldn't really have happened." Yes, yeah. It did. And to me,
it sounds like a movie.
It's one of the most powerful scenes in our whole story as a country.
Ephraim Cutler also became the leading proponent of education in the Ohio Territory, advocating for the first public schools and universities, which is all the more ironic because he was deprived of a proper schooling himself. I wonder if part of Ephraim's drive to provide education for all stemmed from his own insecurities and a sense of having missed out on his own education.
Oh, a great deal. And his grandfather, who had sent Manessa, the father, to Yale, was unable to send him to any college because of financial situations. And apparently, Manessa was not in a position to do much in that respect either.
I see.
So he never went to college. But he was a reader much of his life, and he never learned to spell. Personally, I think that makes him all the more admirable as a character.
Definitely.
And his partner, the other most important voice for public education, Rufus Putnam, had even less education than Ephraim did. And of course, that was not unusual in that day. Many of the women were illiterate. One of the reasons we have so few, almost no letters and diaries kept by them or written by them.
And it wasn't just Ephraim Cutler, but more generally, the pioneers seem to have placed a high value on education. Where did that come from? Why was that?
Because they felt our minds were not capable of understanding or appreciating God unless we could read, most significantly, read the Bible. And they also felt that learning never stopped. The more you learn, the more you wanted to learn. And one of the most touching expressions of that, in my view, is one of the oil paintings is of Joe Barker. Joe Barker, who had no education, who was a carpenter, who then became one of the leading architects of the time, and a superb architect. But in Joe Barker's portrait, when he posed for the portrait, he holds a book. And clearly it's his pride in that book that he doesn't want to be left out of the record of who he was and what he looked like. And he had a library that he built himself. And he was as proud of that library as anything imaginable. Now, keep in mind, too, please, all these people are devoted to their families. And they all had anywhere from 6 to 8 to 10 children.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Joe Barker, by the time he died, are you ready? Had 63 grandchildren.
Oh, that's a lot of birthdays to keep up with.
Well, indeed it is. But it's also a lot of help because the children worked. And work was part of the ethic of life. Manessa Cutler, the preacher from Hamilton, built a third floor onto his parsonage there, all of which are still there by his church and the parsonage.
And now all of your books seem to have something to say about the current era in our history, or perhaps it's just that we're viewing those stories through the lens of the moment. What aspects of this book do you think speak to the current historical moment here in America?
A reminder of our values.
Mm-hmm.
A reminder that there were people who weren't doing what they did bravely and against adversities of all kinds to make a lot of money or to become famous or to possess a lot of valuable show-off possessions. They were doing it in order to attain worthy objectives. And we have to understand that they were coming out of what was the Puritan tradition. Now, I grew up with a general understanding that Puritans were people who always wore black and who never wanted anyone ever to have any fun.
Yeah.
And that's absolutely not true. They wore very colorful clothing, and they loved to sing and dance and have a few drinks, as everybody. But they had certain basic objectives, and one was to be useful, to have a life where your days were useful to the betterment of the community and of your family. If you don't mind, I'd like to just read you something that I think is a wonderful expression of that, and that's one of Joe Barker's granddaughters, Catherine, who would remember how they were raised at home. And I think more and more that how we're raised at home is a subject we need to know more about. Yes, school is of the utmost importance. It's those values, those do's and don'ts of life. Tell the truth, don't cheat, help other people, all of that. It is as important or more important than what we learn at school. At home, the Barker children were raised, as Catherine would remember, quote, to be useful, to be pleasant with our playmates, respectful to superiors, just to all, black or white, good to the poor, not showing pride or selfishness, but kindness and goodwill, and to see to it that we look to our own faults more than the faults of others. And she would love to quote, much of her life, words to the wise that were most frequently repeated by her mother. Count the day lost at which the setting sun sees at its close no worthy action done.
Profound.
How wonderful if we could return to that outlook.
Absolutely.
Bring our children and grandchildren up with that in mind.
Yeah.
Make the world, your family's world, a little better for your having been here.
They really were the very best of America. Now, when you spend years researching people like the pioneers, learning about their lives, what their hopes and disappointments were, what their family life was like, and even what others thought of them, do they begin to feel like old friends? What's that relationship like between a historian and his human subjects?
I'm often asked, are you working on a book? And I say, yes, I am. What I really want to say is I'm working in a book. I get inside the subject, and I get not only inside to know these people, but I get connected to them. I feel connected to Harry Truman and John Adams and the Roeblings who built the Brooklyn Bridge. I feel connected to those people who went to Panama to build the canal. And I always will, as long as I live. And you get to know them in the way you don't know people in real life. Because for one thing, in real life, you don't get to read other people's mail.
And that's true.
And of course, today, nobody even writes letters anymore. So here they're pouring out their innermost thoughts, their ambitions, their worries, their sufferings.
Before we go, I just want to ask you one last question. David, you are now 85 years old and still going strong. Do you look back at history with any more wisdom or a different perspective than you did when you first began writing history 50 or more years ago?
Oh, indeed. And I couldn't have been happier in my work. I've never played golf or tennis or wanted to lie on the beach all day. Yeah. I love my work. I get up every morning and want to get back to work. This is hard for some of my academic friends to understand. I've never undertaken a book on a subject about which I knew very much.
Really?
Really, truly, including this one, including every book I've written. And people say, well, how can you do that, or why do you do that? I don't know. But I feel, if I know all about the subject, I don't want to write the book. Because for me, writing the book is the adventure. Writing the book is, for me, taking the PhD course in the subject. And the curiosity accelerates the farther you go. The more you know, the more you want to know. And I've never undertaken one of these books during which I didn't find something that nobody else had found. And oh, what a lot I've learned. Not just about what happened, when, and so forth, but about the human spirit, the human capacity for admirable behavior, admirable accomplishment. Yes, sure, all of us have our faults and make mistakes. And yes, sure, there are people who are downright evil and duplicitous and disgusting. But they're the shadows, and the shadows are what help us to see the light. And when that light bursts forth, and you see it in the building of a great bridge or a presidency that turns to increasingly admirable the more we know about it, bringing characters who've been misplaced in our lineup is, to me, one of the joys of the way. And with both Harry Truman and John Adams, I feel I had the chance to do that.
Yeah. Isn't it funny, the perspective we get with just a little bit of hindsight?
I just want to tell you one, if I may, one quick story. I grew up in a very old-fashioned Republican family in Pittsburgh. And the night of the 48 election, I was still in high school, and I got very excited about politics and interested in it for the first time, and tried to stay up the night that the election went on. And as you may remember or know, the election wasn't decided until something like 2 in the morning.
Yeah.
And I tried to stay awake, and I simply couldn't. I fell asleep about midnight. And the next morning I got up, and my father was in shaving, and I went in and said, Dad, who won? And he said, Truman, like it was the end of the world. And 30 years, 25 years later, I was back home, and we were sitting chatting after dinner, and he started in about how country was going to hell, the world was going to hell. And he said, after a pause, "Too bad old Harry isn't still in the White House." And we see things differently as time passes. Mm-hmm. You have, as Truman himself used to say, you have to wait for the dust to settle.
Yeah.
To really see what we call the past. And always, yeah, we should always remember there is no such thing. There was no such thing as the past. Everybody, they didn't live in the past. They didn't walk around. Isn't this fascinating, living in the past? It was in the present. And yeah, they had no more idea how it was all going to turn out than we do.
That is so true. Wise words. Well, I thoroughly enjoyed the book, and I can't recommend it enough to folks listening. It's called The Pioneers, The Heroic Story of the Settlers Who Brought the American Ideal West. David McCullough, it's been such a pleasure and an honor. Thank you for talking with me.
Thank you, Ben, very much. And keep up your good work.
Thanks again to the great David McCullough for coming on the podcast. Order his new book, The Pioneers, The Heroic Story of the Settlers Who Brought the American Ideal West, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Ancestry DNA gives you so much more than just the places you're from. Ancestry connects you to the places in the world where your story started using precise geographic detail and clear-cut historical insights. You can even trace your ancestors' journey over time, following how and why your family moved from place to place. Go to Ancestry.com today to purchase your Ancestry DNA kit. That's Ancestry.com to purchase your Ancestry DNA kit. Ancestry.com. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts if you haven't already. And if you like what you're hearing, then rate and review us while you're there. 5-star reviews are the easiest way for new listeners to find us. Don't forget to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at KickassNewsPod. And feel free to email me with your thoughts, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. Until next time, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.